So, Bob, this is another lost episode that we recorded a few months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
In early October, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it was stuck in one of the pharaoh tombs.
What's that mean?
It was stuck in one of the pharaoh tombs.
Pharaoh tombs.
Yeah.
I thought you said one of the tubes. Like, I thought it was some weird term for, like, pneumatic tube. And in my head, remember those pneumatic tubes?
Oh, I want one.
I know, right?
They're still fun.
Wouldn't it be fun if we had a pneumatic tube between our two houses and we could just randomly send?
Yeah, I could bring your shoes over without having to leave.
Yeah. I left my shoes at Bob's house because we were having a good time and I didn't forget. Anyway, point is this episode is an episode that we're publishing anew, but we recorded it a few months ago. So just keep that in mind. Let's listen to that episode. What do you say, Bob?
Yep.
So Bob, I thought we would answer some of the people's questions. What do you say?
Well, let's do at least one of them.
Yeah. So Carrie from Arkansas has the following question on the survey we sent out to everyone. It says, I consider my connection to people to be my most valuable asset. I also find more motivation in doing things together with other people. Is this why you like to do podcasts with Umberto and Bob? Oh, that question's for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, one, love the opportunity to hang out with Bob and Umberto and Rebecca because they're my best friends and it's fun. And I never wanted to do this podcast on my own. In fact, years ago, I decided to do an episode on my own and I was like, I felt really weird about it and I thought it would just be a one-off, but people liked it. So I did more of that. So yeah, my natural inclination is to always do things with other people. When I'm doing music, I always enjoy being in bands as to being on my own because I can record all the instruments myself and there's a lot less hassle when you're by yourself, but it doesn't feel emotionally as euphoric to be by yourself. There's a lot of euphoria in creating a together thing, to be vibing with other people and, you know, in sync. I get more motivation. Although I will say I hate group projects at school because
we were never on one together, were we?
No.
But I did one with Nanette.
For all the reasons that people talk about. I'm too OCPD, you know what I mean? And I mean, if I were in a class where I wanted to slack, then I would love being a part of a group project.
Sure.
But I'm usually not. Anyway, Helen says, I started a new job in the palliative department.
Wow.
How to console people who have lost a loved one? Bob, what do you think?
Stick to cliches, because what really counts is your attention. You're not going to say anything new. You're not going to say anything that's like never been said in all the history of people having, you know, pain or whatever. So I take the advice of one of my old friends, a really good guy, psychiatrist. He's like, Bob, just stick to the cliches and say them with, you know, be authentic. But I'm sorry for your loss is a reasonable thing to say to somebody when they're in pain.
If it's genuine,
yeah.
And it's not just you say that and walk away. You know, if you're there,
yeah.
And you say it and
right.
And you mean it.
Yeah, that's because meaning it is all that really matters. Is genuine care is really all people. That's all you can offer. And they're going to be in pain. It's not like you can do anything to take that away, nor would you even want to. It's not good for us. But your attention is a big deal. People shy away from illness and death. We're all scared of it. So we'll leave people alone when they need us most. So your willingness to move towards and offer consoling and care is gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. I don't have anything to add to that. I do want to make an announcement, though. So my mentor, Phil Cushman.
Oh, yeah.
I did an episode about him dying a little bit ago.
Right.
And I talked about some of the details, and I want to give an update.
Yeah.
And some of you might know this because there was a news article about it, but I didn't read the article, so I probably should have, but I did talk with the family. And so to catch you up, we knew soon after his death, he was found on the side of the road dead nearby his house while he was on a walk talking to his friend, his best friend on the phone, and then was hit by a car.
Ugh.
They figured out.
Yeah.
And it, you know, like hit and run, da da da. And there was this hunt to find the person. But it was assumed, and I assumed it was an accident. But there's some evidence that it might not have been.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's no way to know at this point. But they did find the person. I think he might have come forward, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
I'm not sure. But somehow they identified the person. And he has a history of mental illness, schizophrenia in particular. This is all alleged, by the way, and this is all through the family, but this is what I was gleaning from what they were telling me. And there is a possibility that he actually, the driver, swerved into the other lane to hit him, to hit Phil.
God.
So Phil was walking on the correct side of the road. You're supposed to walk on
against traffic.
Yeah. He also had a fair amount of shoulder, which I was kind of worried about because the road he was walking on Vashon, it doesn't have like, there's not a sidewalk. So you're just walking on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And the road that I heard he was walking on, it doesn't have much of a shoulder, but apparently where he was, there was a frame. And he was pretty safety conscious. He usually would do this walk all the time. And, you know, he knew what he was doing anyway. So he's on that side of the road. And so the driver was behind him, right? So driving on the right side of the road.
Yeah.
And Phil's all the way on the other side of the road, walking away from him.
Right.
And the driver, according to evidence anyway, swerved into the other lane and then into the shoulder to hit him. You know, like, that's not an accident, right? It'd be hard to imagine that you could accidentally go that far and coincidentally it's right where Phil was. And there's no evidence of braking or, you know, rubber on the road or anything.
Just
hit him and moved on, right?
Oh, God.
And again, allegedly, he, according to him, is making reports that he was schizophrenic and symptomatic at the time and is claiming insanity at the time of the crime. So it's tragic that he died, obviously. It was tragic that he died what I thought was an accident, which just seems even... Because if someone has, you know, cancer or something, I don't know, for me it just feels like, well, you know, those things happen. But when it's something that could have been prevented like this, right? But then you learn it's possibly murder.
Yeah.
Manslaughter, whatever you want. I don't know what the legal term would be, but then it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
The tragedy of it and the senselessness of it.
Right.
And the deep irony of it, because if Phil were here, because he was such a brilliant mind and a political thinker and a historical thinker, he would have hours of analysis of the factors that led into his own murder. He would have history going back to the 1800s or before that led up to that moment, that led up to the lack of funding for mental health care, the lack of awareness, the lack of beds. Washington State, apparently, strangely, even though we're the most liberal, we're one of the most liberal areas in the world, and or in the United States anyway, and we also presumably value mental health more than other areas, we have very little allocation of taxes for beds in mental health hospitals. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
I think per capita or per need in Washington State, we're like in the bottom 10 states in the union or something. Damn. I can't remember exactly, but it's not great. And Phil would have so much to say about that. He would want to talk about how the tragedy that people aren't getting the help that they need, that our government is actively pushing against this sort of thing, that they ignore. You know, he would just have, I don't know how to, you know, lecture what he would lecture, but sure. I just know he would have a way of framing this that would be both mind-blowing and scathing against a system that has been present for a long time. You know, he just would be able to do that. And because again, if it was cancer or something, then it, or an accident, it's like, well, you know, what do you say? If people accidentally, they don't see you, it's a little later at night, or, you know, it's obviously horrible. But to be murdered by someone that was let down by the mental health system, to be murdered by someone that probably was reaching out for help and wanted help for many, many years, is just a special kind of irony that I think Phil would not only scathe, but he would also appreciate on some level. Is to be like, well, it's fitting.
Did that person target him, or is it
him particularly?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like it, because there's no connection to him. There's no indication that he knew Phil.
So it's
possible he just...
Just about a person on the street at the time.
Wrong place, wrong time or something.
Oh.
And So I was at the memorial, which was nice to go to with everyone giving their stories and seeing some old faces. But I don't know. I don't have much to say other than that. I've been processing it and have been since I heard about it. And I just wanted to give everyone an update. I don't know if any of that is accurate or, you know, it's a lot of preliminary stuff at this point. Yeah. But I don't know. I just feel like people should know. And if you're upset about it, channel it into voting and advocating for allocation of funds from taxes or the raising of taxes or the reduction of taxes spent on stealth bombers or special interest for oil companies so that there could be more beds, more resources. Because when people with mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, are given resources, they use it when it is humane and available and they will avail themselves of it. And when they are given proper treatment, the chance of them doing anything, you know, above average in terms of harming other people, it goes away.
It goes away.
The you know, when we have, because there is a slight increase in risk of these kinds of crimes when you have a severe mental illness, but that risk completely goes away when the individual is given enough treatment.
Treatment.
And the way you do that is you have tax dollars. You know, when people talk about mental health crisis, when they talk about there's not enough this and that, what really we're talking about is tax dollars being raised and or allocated to double, triple, quadruple the amount of clinicians on the ground, the amount of beds, the amount of facilities, the amount of money paid so that people can get free medication, the amount of halfway houses, the amount of chemical dependency treatment, the amount of facilities that will house people with mental health and trauma and chemical dependency issues. They're, you know, paying for psychiatrists and caseworkers and outreach individuals and, you know, obviously trauma specialists and chemical dependency. You know, when you have those funds, then the problem gets addressed. But without the money, it's all just talk. And the federal government allocated $10 billion or $100 billion over 10 years, which is great, but that's like 1 or 3% of what's needed. And so we just have to prioritize it and make some sacrifices. Everyone has to buck up. Everyone has to contribute. I don't know how much that would be. You know, maybe it's, especially if you're on the richer end, maybe it's $1,000 a year to pay for everyone in this union to get civil and humane care. And that would also include care for people like you and me that might not suffer from a severe mental illness, but might also at times find it difficult to afford proper therapy, you know, when we are in our 20s or something. The tax dollars could be used for that as well, which would be an overall good. We are the richest nation that has ever lived. We can afford it. It's just a matter of caring and being logical, because when we don't do that, bad things happen. Bad things happen when people are walking around Seattle and they're like, I don't like these homeless people. It's just like, well, then buck up, fucker. Like, then vote, then pay your taxes or give to charities or something. Don't just say, well, you got to round them up. You know what I mean? Like, it's a matter of money, taxes. Anyway, I'm angry, I guess, about it. And let's take a break and get back. More questions. What do you say, Bob?
Okay.
All right, we're back from the break. Next question. Paige has a question. Can you talk about dissociative identity disorder? Some therapists overdiagnose, some don't believe it exists. What about you and Bob? Have you come across clients with dissociative identity disorder?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Bob, I have this timer.
Oh.
Because I hate digital timers. I have an actual hourglass.
An hourglass.
That is graded for 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
So between you and me, we will take 2 minutes. Go.
Yes. I worked with somebody who had DID before I went to graduate school when I was a case manager at the mental health clinic down in Renton, and got to know her quite well, actually, over a period of about 2 years, maybe a little less than 2 years. And I really liked her. She was just really lovely and very troubled. That said, I don't know much about DID. Though one of the things that I think about these days, kind of interested in your opinion about this, Kirk, is how it can be iatrogenic by, caused by therapists who are interested in the, fascinated by
DID.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yes, all true. It has been faked in some famous... It's really ridiculous that there are clinicians claiming it doesn't exist because the experts all concur that it absolutely exists. So there's that. It's in the DSM. If it's in the DSM, especially for this long, I mean, there's some problems with the DSM, the paraphilias, blah, blah, blah. But you know that the DSM doesn't let things in very easily. And so DID is a thing. Of course, it's a thing. It is highly related to other disorders. It's not really on its own category. There are a lot of other dissociative disorders that are akin to that. And so it's not hard to imagine it. It is quite fantastical when you think about it. And that's why there's a lot of movies and stuff about it that really aren't doing them a lot of favors. Mm-hmm. And can some therapists overdiagnose this? Yes. Can some people fake it? Yes, there are cases. But something like the research shows something like 10-15% of cases of DID have been found to be faked. Plus, the vast majority of people who are eventually diagnosed with DID don't present to therapy with DID. They come in with depression. Suicidality and memory problems. And so it is something that... And it's something that is not pleasant. There's a new trend on TikTok where people seemingly are faking having it.
Oh.
Yeah. So
that's weird.
Yeah. I'm now realizing this timer, Bob, once it gets to a certain, you know, you see a little bit left in the top chamber here. I think it just stops. Or no, it's still going, but it kind of gets a little stuck.
It needs the weight of
Okay. I needed to jiggle it a little bit. Well, anyway,
you should time your timer and see if it's.
Next question. Katie from Bellingham, I'm curious about how you have both felt since the audience of the podcast has grown huge in the last 2 years. What are some of your favorite things about this rapid growth, and what are some challenging things? Bob, I don't even know if you know that it's grown over the past couple of years, but do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, the paparazzi are awful.
Well, I guess you have maybe noticed more people emailing you.
Yeah, I have.
And leaving notes at your office and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want that to happen.
No, I do not.
Yeah. Talk about that for a bit.
I would like that person to stop leaving me notes.
Yeah. Why?
Because it's creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes you feel unsafe?
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You can email.
Yeah. You send an email.
Yeah. I will say that people have left me notes, like that one person left me a note on my car, you know, windshield wiper, and that didn't creep me out.
No.
And I don't know if that would have you either.
No.
Because that's like out and about. I was parked by my university. But this is your office. It's kind of like an extension of your house and da da da. So yeah. Anyway. But for me, favorite thing about rapid growth. Oh, I mean, I'm mainly at this point post Johnny Depp trial am really just thinking about the downside of growth. So there's that. One of the benefits of rapid growth is I can pay everyone, actually, which I couldn't really before. Also, I was able to dedicate all of my work hours, for the most part, aside from my small private practice and occasionally teaching, to the podcast. So that, and I love doing it. So that's a huge favorite thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
Challenging thing is that there are mobs of people that are looking for someone to bully, and because I'm a little bit more famous, I will cross their radar and will get into their crosshairs, and it sucks, and I hate it. Another downside to being more popular is I feel like sometimes people think of us as famous, privileged people, you know? I think there's a certain attitude towards people that are successful. I can't remember what the quote is from, but the quote is, to become famous, you have to be relatable. And when you're famous, you're no longer relatable.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And so I feel that sometimes from people, not the core fans, but there are some people that sort of fly-by-night listeners or people, they'll sort of talk about me the way they talk about politicians or super famous people in this very dehumanizing way, as if I'm untouchable or as if I don't have a thin skin or something. And it hurts my feelings. All right. Next question. Dan, for some reason, from San Antonio, Texas, maybe. Dan, for some reason, we know that person. What would be the most complimentary way a client could describe you? For example, my therapist was Bob Gettle. He was blank. Bob, what do you think?
Oh, kind, wise, helpful. Helpful. I'd say that probably it.
Yeah. Helpful.
I mean, I don't need anybody to write a book about me. It's not important.
Yeah.
Though I, you know, I always take such, when people say that to me direct, I always take it with a grain of salt because it's a pretty high demand situation. Hmm. I don't ever solicit, would never, golly, no, never solicit. But I have noticed at times when people seem to be not so self-aware, not so like, not having what looks to me like any kind of agenda other than appreciation, have said something kind to me about how I've been useful to them. And that's really lovely, gratifying. It's not why I do my job, but it's nice.
Meaning you don't do it for the compliments.
No.
You do it to be helpful.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Same word for me. Jeremiah says, I have cried probably 3 times in the past 15 years.
Wow.
I know you, Dr. Honda, said that you went a long period of time without crying.
Really?
Yeah. Well, maybe not without crying at all, but rarely crying.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Toxic masculinity. I was trying. I learned when I figured when I was in the 5th or 6th grade that crying as a boy was wrong. And so I went on a campaign to, I don't know how it occurred to me, but I intuited or something that if I converted tears and pain and sorrow into anger, I wouldn't cry.
Oh, sure.
And I remember walking around and I would have this urge to cry because you know how that feels.
I do.
And I would clench my fists and I would grit my teeth.
Wow.
And I'd be like, urgh! You know, I'd sort of mock, emote.
Oh, yeah.
A sense of anger.
That will work too.
And it worked. It completely erased the tears. So I didn't cry for a long time. And then when I became a therapist, I'm like, that's got to change.
Yeah.
And I went on a campaign. And so
good for you.
It was really hard. So that's what they're saying. You know, how did you get yourself to cry? So Jeremiah, I remember this really quite distinctly. I would be in a situation where I'd be like, I bet you this is one of those moments where I would normally cry.
Mm-hmm.
And I would literally try to push the tears out of my tear ducts. And I don't know if that makes any sense, but I would also try to push like that feeling that you get in your throat where you're kind of sobbing. And mm-hmm. I don't know, there's a certain, I would just sort of concentrate on those facial autonomic responses. And I would, and it took me a long time, and I would try to focus on the sadness, you know, and I think I would tell myself like, it's okay to cry. Like if you need to cry, it's okay. And over the span of years, very slowly it started to happen. Then once I did cry, then I could more easily identify what that felt like. You know, actors can do this, right? They can actually,
it's a teachable skill.
Yeah. You can actually teach yourself to involuntarily cry or to voluntarily cry. And, it was along those lines. And now I cry automatically all the time.
Naturally.
Yeah. But frequently, you know,
mm-hmm.
like under some very light circumstances. But I consider that to be a natural state.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I would say it's natural to cry every day about something, you know, or tear up a little bit.
A lot of sadness out there.
Yeah. And I also cry when there's glory. You know, if someone does something wonderful, if I see some tenderness or goodness or sacrifice, or if I'm appreciative, or if I feel loved or I love, you know, or I see a kitten or something.
Oh, kittens.
Anonymous says, hello, Kirk and Bob. How or when to let your child know about your own trauma? I'm having my first child. I went through sexual assault as a kid, also abuse and neglect from both parents. I have been in therapy for years and made a lot of progress, and I don't want to introduce my child to this information while she is small, but I do want to let her know eventually so she can truly know me. How much is okay to tell her? What age is best? How do I introduce this to her safely, Bob?
I don't know. I knew that people talk about such things and they couch them in terms of what's developmentally appropriate for a child in a particular age, what it means to 2 or 4 or 6 or 12 or, you know, 19 or whatever. And I don't know how to do that, so I don't have any advice, though I'm glad you're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
The thought that did occur to me, though, is not that you should keep yourself secret, but raising a child isn't so much about you being known as in being aware of the kid and where they're at. So, I don't know anything about parenting, really. I mean, I've never been one, but it did strike me that perhaps one mm-hmm. considers the well-being of the child over other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't want to fall into a trap of saying somehow that you sharing your trauma with people is somehow damaging to others, because it isn't inherently. It's often framed that way. It can be, but it's not shameful. It's not something that you have to never tell anyone about. So I want to have that as a caveat. But I also want to piggyback on what Bob is saying, that I'm more worried about the overall value that you have or outcome that you're looking for her to quote unquote truly know you. Because if it's, I don't know, but it's possible you're overcompensating for the shitty parenting that you went through, and you equate good parenting as being very, very enmeshed and oversharing with your kids. You know, the fact that you have a young child and you have this impulse to share this with her, and you're just like, and I don't know, maybe it's just a random question that you decided to put on the internet, but I would address that in therapy more globally, in terms of, and maybe even more globally, of like, okay, well, here's what I was shown to be shitty parenting. What do I need to avoid? Because there are certain acts as a parent that will feel natural to you because it was the way you were treated, and you need to obviously not do that. But also, you might not have ever been given a model of within normal range parenting, and so you might not know exactly where that is, and you might overshoot it in some areas. So that would be one thing to think about. Obviously, also, you want a village around you. You don't want to just parent by yourself. That's usually, risky. But in terms of how much is okay to tell her, it depends on what the effect is. You know, some kids are more sensitive to that than others. Some kids are totally fine with it. Some kids really want to know this information. What age is best? It's hard to know exactly, obviously, because every kid's different. It depends on what you're saying. But if I were to have a general guideline, I would say when the kid is 25 or older, honestly, because there's no reason to tell her about this. I understand that you want to share it, and I understand you probably, it sounds like it's a part of your identity, like about who you are as a person. Now, you can absolutely tell your kid at age appropriate that you've been through some stuff and you don't want to go into details, but you were raised in a way that was not great. And that explains why, you know, you could be like, sometimes mommy overreacts or has a hard time emotionally or is in therapy, and it's because mommy went through some stuff when she was young, and so just know that I am protecting you from things that I went through, and I'm working on it, and I have my people that I'm talking to. So things like that, obviously, when the kid is a teenager, that could be more easily explained. But yeah, that's my answer to that. Lisa from Illinois says, my therapist has diagnosed me with generalized anxiety disorder and ADHD, but my medical provider thinks my ADHD symptoms are from anxiety and will not refer me for an evaluation. Could this be true? What's the best way to navigate getting evaluated for ADHD as an adult? Bob, what do you think?
Do you need your medical provider to okay it? Why would any medical provider get in the way of somebody seeking information?
It's possible that in order to get a proper evaluation or an evaluation that is paid for by their insurance, it's possible that their primary provider actually has to offer
that. Yeah, no, I have insurance like that too, but yeah. I'm wondering, why would a medical provider want to get in the way of a person gathering information, especially when it's not their area of expertise?
Yes, that's a problem.
Okay.
And HMOs like Kaiser Permanente and other places, because they will pressure the primary, you know, physician costs, they will say, they'll look statistically at their client, their patient numbers, and say, you are over-referring people out to specialists, and it's very expensive to get a full ADHD assessment.
Yeah, there's a problem with that model in terms of medical care, but okay, yeah. I hear you. So maybe push, get a second opinion about it from another GP at your clinic. Get a different GP. Let's see, what else? I don't know. What else?
Yeah. Well, you have been diagnosed. Your therapist, who knows you probably the best,
yeah, probably,
says you have generalized anxiety and ADHD, but your medical provider thinks your ADHD symptoms are from your anxiety and will not refer you for an evaluation.
Well, they could always prescribe stimulants and see if they do any good.
I suppose. Your therapist, I don't know, it kind of depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for treatment for ADHD, your therapist can help you with the psychotherapy side of that.
Yeah.
If you're looking for meds like psychostimulants, then yeah, you would need a medical referral for that. It's possible, even if you're at a with an HMO, that you can call a psychiatrist directly. I don't know. And then once you're with what?
Group Health had that. That you could call their mental health department directly. You didn't have to go to your...
Right.
Yeah.
So something along those lines. You ask, could it be true that your ADHD symptoms are from your anxiety? Yeah, that happens all the time. There's ADHD is both overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed, and it's overapplied to individuals that have anxiety or other kinds of issues because, yeah, you do have all the symptoms or enough symptoms of ADHD, but there are reasons for it that don't have anything to do with your prefrontal cortex and your executive function. It's just an growth of other issues. But I would be surprised if your medical provider knew enough information to be able to make that determination, because that's a complicated thing to tease out. It takes a fair amount of time. And I'm also guessing your therapist has assessed in much more elaborate ways that would give that diagnosis much more credence, but I don't know. But I will say that I have heard of some people running into a lot of barriers who are trying to get assessment and medication for ADHD. Because the reason for that is there's a fair amount of people who abuse ADHD meds who are maybe even selling them on the street. And there's a lot of scammers out there, you know, med seekers who are poisoning the well for those people who actually legitimately need an evaluation. So Becca says, what's the impact on children of an untreated mental illness of a parent? My dad has struggled with schizophrenia and depression most of his adult life. He was not dealing with psychosis when I was growing up. He wasn't receiving treatment or therapy at the time, and I had no idea he had any mental illness until I was in my late 20s. I'm guessing that's when the psychosis happened. Mm. I've been working through this in my own therapy over the past 7 months, but I would love to hear yours and Bob's perspective on this topic, because you guys are great and I really enjoy hearing what you both have to say. Bob, what do you think?
Well, that's nice. What was the question?
What's the impact on children of an untreated mental illness in a parent?
I don't know how to answer that.
Pretty broad.
Yeah. So broad. That's so crappy. I don't like my answer, but I don't know. It would be hard to know. I mean, what's the impact of any parent on their kid? You know, like, I suppose if I'm looking for impact, I mean, this is not an academic study, right? They're not trying to write a book report on the impact of mental illness. You're curious about your own well-being and welfare. Maybe it makes sense to kind of treat it phenomenologically, like what's going on for me, and what's the connection between what's going on for me and how I, you know, my experience of my dad when I was growing up. But I don't really know how to answer it any more than that. Mm-hmm. I don't really love that answer.
The common things that I'll hear are that if you have a depressed schizophrenic parent, of course, everyone's different, but it will potentially impact a parent's ability to stay on task or to pay attention to you or to be energetic. Schizophrenia can cause also people to be a little disjointed. You know, early development, you know, early symptoms of schizophrenia can cause people to be anxious, can cause people to be emotionally volatile or emotionally stunted, depending on where they're at. It can obviously cause people to seem like they're confused, or they have a lot of persecutory ideas about the government or something, and maybe even about you or their spouse. You know, there's a lot of possibilities, but the bottom line is generally, and it can also cause a lot of drug abuse. So the bottom line is that in all likelihood, you went through some situations in which you weren't parented ideally and you weren't attuned to ideally, but it's hard to know. All right, let's take a break and we get back more questions. What do you say, Bob?
Yep.
All right, last few questions here. Leah says, anonymous patron says, Bob, what feelings do you feel when you think of the way your father abused you? Do you have a technique to process any emotions that you might feel? What feelings do you feel when you think of the way your father abused you? I'm guessing anonymous patron's like, I'm similar to you, Bob, okay. And I feel these feelings. What do you feel when you think about your father abusing you? And do you have a technique to process the emotions you might feel?
I feel sad, I feel angry, and sometimes I feel ashamed. I don't have a technique that I use to process those things. I mean, well, I go to therapy.
Well, I imagine compared to the average person, you feel them and validate them internally.
Oh, yeah.
You don't suppress them or shame yourself for them.
No. I mean, I have shame, but I don't generally shame myself for feeling the way I feel.
You allow yourself to feel them.
Yeah. Sometimes I worry that I fixate on being angry, like blamey and, you know, judgy and shitty. And I do wish I had more empathy for him. He was not a bad guy. He's a good guy. But he was a guy in the crosshairs, man. Like, he had four children by the time he was 29, and he was ill-equipped. I'm 55. I don't have any kids. And my life has got its challenges. So,
and presumably he went through some stuff when he was a kid.
Oh, bad stuff. I know some of it. And very odd, very strange things, not just bad, but strange.
Like what?
Well, his parents were older. His mother was 40. His father was 42 when he was born. So my father was born in 1938. And when he was born, his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer and she died when he was 15. So she was ill the entirety of his life. They shared one room, him and his folks, my dad's an only child. They shared one room. I think they probably had a pretty strange marriage. They both late in life getting married. I mean, I got married when I was 41, so whatever. But they got together late in the 30s. Like, that's a long time ago. And they lived with her sisters who were angry with her for breaking the whatever deal, the pact they made that none of them were going to get married. So him and his mom and dad shared a room on the top floor of the three-story house. And his sisters each had their own room on the second floor. And then on the ground floor, you know, the main living area. At dinner time, my parents and my dad, or my grandparents and my father would eat in one room. And his sisters would eat in another room and they wouldn't talk to each other. It was just weird, right? Though they did like my dad. They doted on him and he would say some fond things, at least about some of them. Aunt Teresa, he liked her. And I don't know if he liked the other ones as much, but...
Was he abused, your dad?
Yeah, and he was abused. He shared a bed with his dad, and his mom slept in a different bed in their one room, which I always found just kind of creepy and weird. And his father, aloof and angry and not a good dad. Mm-hmm. Not up to it.
And mom struggling with medical issues.
With medical issues. And she and he were pretty close, though I suspect that some of the ways in which they were close were not so great, but I don't have a lot of information about that. Mm-hmm. And then she passed when he was 15, so he's pretty much on his own.
This in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, back in Philadelphia. And when he was 17, he got in a fight with his dad and left, and he moved next door and finished high school. And then... put himself through college. He did night school 5 nights a week for 4 years to get himself through college. And he would date my mom. They'd have Saturday nights. That was the one time that they'd see each other. And other than that, he was working or taking classes for 4 years straight. I mean, my dad is a really amazing human in that he is self-made. He did that. He paid for it himself. He stuck it out. Smart guy. It was good that he did it. He wanted to be a civil engineer. And he said, I didn't know how to do geometry, which I have a hard time believing my father would be challenged by something like that.
Probably just had a bad teacher.
Yeah, that's more than likely. Yeah. And so he became a CPA, an accountant, and he did that for his entire career. And he's good at it. And, you know, thorough guy and, you know, smart, really smart man. But I'm Catholic and my mom Catholic. And that will have an impact, at least the way Catholicism is in Philadelphia will have, but I think it's probably national, but I think it's probably worldwide. There's a particular kind of impact that that kind of religion will have on a person that will limit them and oppress them. So he's 29 years old and he has his fourth kid, and you know, like, it's too much. It's too much when he was 22, 23, when they were getting started. And I wish I had more empathy for him, but I'm really angry with him for, you know, I sort of think that sucks, and also that's no excuse. It's what's both inevitable and inexcusable all at the same time, to abuse your children. So,
yeah, I mean, as you say that, it's like inevitable that he would have reactivity and issues and maybe be at least kind of abusive, but if he had put more effort and more self-awareness and opened himself up to feedback a little bit more, he probably would have abused you a lot less.
Yeah.
So that was his choice, to avoid something that a lot of people avoid, particularly back then, but it wasn't unheard of for people to try to work on it.
When I was in third grade or thereabouts, my sister was having some behavioral problems, and I don't actually know the details of that, but they started taking her down to Temple University. It's one of the schools in Philadelphia area, one of the big schools in psych department, and she was getting evaluated, and they took her four Saturdays. They didn't just Saturday mornings for 4 weeks. I used to feel sad because she missed Saturday cartoons, and the upshot of it was they said to my parents, she's fine. She's actually quite bright. My sister's really bright, but she's having some, I think it was school troubles, academic trouble. I said, there's nothing, everything's good with this kid. You got to lay off her. Hmm. And he actually made some effort to lay off her. And we had a specific talk. I still remember it on a Sunday night at dinner. And dad's not going to hit you anymore. That was the upshot of the thing. You know, like nowadays, it's just
nothing about you though.
No, not about me specific. No, just, in general, this will no longer be a disciplinary practice in this household. It didn't really stick, but you know, it's abhorrent to me to think that somebody has to like hire a professional to figure out that you shouldn't hit your kid. You know, like, come on, it's not rocket science. So, anyways, sometimes I get frustrated, or not frustrated, I get concerned that maybe I walk around with an axe to grind against him, and I do still feel angry with him.
What's the downside of having an axe to grind?
It lacks context. It doesn't see a bigger picture.
I think it incorporates a lot of context.
Yeah.
He was abusive to you. That's the context.
There's no doubt about it. But does it lock me? I'm not talking about him. Does it lock me in a particular mindset of hopelessness or helplessness? Hmm. You know, like, I've got this guy I can blame for, you know, some of my troubles in life. And it's not untrue on the one hand. But on the other hand, is that where it ends? And one of the things I've been noticing about me is how little imagination I have for what else might be. Like, here's one for you. Yeah, we just have a moment, don't we? Last Tuesday at therapy, my therapist, he's kind of a fun guy. He's like, Bob, today's Blue Plate special is care and kindness. That's what we're offering you today, if you want it. You can have the table scraps if you like, but we are offering you care and kindness. So, and I find myself feeling like dumbstruck by that, not knowing what it means, not knowing what, how to receive it or whatever, not being able to think very well. And I think it's just, in a way, it's just kind of a flooding that takes place. But I wonder sometimes if I'm attached to a narrow worldview that won't allow me to, you know, have a fuller expression of or experience of life. Hmm. Like, if I'm attached to it, you know, like the devil you know over the devil you don't kind of thing.
I mean, are you saying that if you took his context more into consideration,
yeah,
that you would maybe have some tempering of your anger and resentment towards him, and thus maybe more generally your assumptions or reactivity or narrative would somehow open up into a clearing where you would have more freedom of option? I'm reading in a lot to what you're saying, but is that what you're saying?
I'm saying something like that. I think I'd prefer to just feel sad about my poor father's suffering in life. I'd like to feel sadder about it. Mm-hmm. My mom too.
Yeah. So on one hand, I, you know, literally like 50% of me is on board with that perspective, because I think that opening ourselves up and having releasing ourselves from our typical, you know, routine narrative and vibe can really give us a freedom to be like, okay, who am I and what am I and how do I want to be in the world? I think, you know, it's a very humanistic idea. On the other hand, being angry for the rest of your life at the injustice that you endured as a defenseless little child for so long, I don't see any real downside to that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're hurt and pissed off. It happens.
What if we lived to be 1,000?
Then you're hurt and pissed off for the rest of your life? I don't know. I don't really see any downside to it. I don't see any, if that's the way that it is, then that's the way that it is.
And well, yeah.
I think in our American society, you're going to get a lot of messages around like, let it go, or it's plaguing you. And I'm like, well, I guess if we can erase history, then yeah, let's do that. But if you can't, then, and on a semi-daily basis, you run into symptoms of what you went through.
And that is true.
So it's not just some distant abstract event. Like every day you deal with impulses and reactivity and vulnerabilities that directly are related to what you went through. And so it's ever present, you know. Even if you decided to quote unquote let go of the anger at your dad, you still are stuck with your attachment injuries today.
Right.
You know, you might as well have something to yell at. That's accurate, right? You might as well have someone to identify as the cause. I don't know. I don't really see any downside to that.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to feel angry. I don't walk around thinking, oh, I know, I'll just stoke this flame. It's just what is. Mm-hmm. So on the other hand, that's just what is. Part of what is anyways.
Last final question, 30 seconds because I know you have to go.
Okay.
By directing your anger at your dad in your mind, might you avoid being angry at other people?
Do you mean like, it's a defense?
No, it's a good thing that you're actually directing angry. If you aren't able to feel validated in your soul of your anger towards your dad, might that anger get redirected towards people that don't deserve it?
Yes.
Right.
I think that's what he did.
He directed it towards you.
Yeah.
When he should have been directing it towards his dad.
His dad or the other bits of life that were, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, you might as well. You know, that's what we're trying to do as therapists. We're always trying to say, let's not displace.
Yeah.
Let's place.
Yeah, place. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right on.
And if the feelings are there, then they're there. All right, well, that does it for that episode. Sorry, Leah. I said your name. We'll get to your question next time. It'll be first on deck. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself and go Mariners because
you deserve it.